Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Let's have a look at the front pages first. So, you see, in retrospect, like, it was a hostage of fortune for the Taoiseach to say when he was giving multi-annual funding to RTE that most organisations would, quotes, give their right arm. And they most organisations clearly thought he's right. So the front of the Sunday Times is the IMO, the INMO, the ASTI, the WHEEL, a charity and voluntary representative body, all saying, yes, he's right. We'd like multi-annual long-term support as well so we can plan things and everything. The picture on the front of the Sunday Times is Laura Whitmore. And she has said that she raised concerns about inappropriate behaviour on Strictly Come Dancing when she appeared on the programme in 2016, alleging that what happened to me in the rehearsal rooms during my time on BBC Strictly was wrong. And there's a lot of other mutterings and murmurings among various ex-contestants. I saw yesterday that the production staff on Strictly have now come out, and a lot of them, there are various people among the production staff, are saying we were in a toxic work environment and all kinds of comments and behaviour and everything. So I think that the case at the heart of this, Amanda Abingdon, the actress, there's going to be a judgment on that in some way tomorrow. Both sides are claiming that they will come out of it as the winner. But anyway, that story is kind of intensifying, if anything, I think, for the BBC. The Sunday Independent is leading with HSE warns UHL staff of disciplinary action over Aoife death. This is the death of Aoife Johnston, you will recall. And the HSE has notified staff at University Hospital Limerick of potential disciplinary proceedings arising from that investigation. They also have, by the way, that actress Saoirse Ronan has married her long-term partner in a secret ceremony in Scotland. He is a guy called Jack Loudon. The Business Post is leading with Bank Bonanza. Lenders set to pay out $3 billion to shareholders. AIB and Bank of Ireland forecast issue interim dividends for the first time since the bailout. And look, you know, that might annoy you, but on the other hand, it's good that they're making money, because if they were losing money, we'd probably have to give them the money. So at least better they're self-sufficient. The Irish Mail on Sunday leading with the Taoiseach talking about the recent revelations about Bishop Eamon Casey, and the headline is Taoiseach put Casey victims wishes first. Harris's message to church as it considers moving Bishop's remains. The Sun is leading with a take on that RTE funding. The mum of an 8-year-old girl waiting for crucial back surgery has told of her fury over the $725 million RTE bailout. Joanne Savage is angry and on behalf of herself and her daughter Hannah, and a picture of the two of them on the front of the Sun on Sunday. And she thinks that they should be able to find money to clear those waiting lists for spinal operations. And the Sunday Mirror is leading with Raymond Shorten, the serial rapist. His daughter today reveals a letter she sent him in jail, calling him a disgusting waste of a human, among other things. Okay, our panel this morning: Alan Barrett is CEO of the ESRI. Sarah McGuinness is assistant news editor of the Business Post. Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan of Maynooth University is the author of Poor. And Mary Hannafin is the former Minister for Education and a newly minted barrister, a devil still at the moment. Is that right, Mary?
I think I might have been called a devil more often than now, but okay. About to start as a devil, yes.
Okay, so yeah. A new life as a devil for you. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Will we start with something that is convulsing the world at the moment and convulsing some of you? So, Alan, the Sunday Independent: drag parody of Da Vinci's Last Supper sparks backlash over Olympic opener.
Yeah, so this is the story that apparently is doing the rounds internationally. Now, I have this emerges from the opening ceremony of the Olympics. And I will say I was glued to the 4 hours of it, enjoyed it enormously. Didn't notice anything in the whole thing that I would have sort of found offensive, or I didn't sort of touch on anything that I thought anybody else, apart from maybe some of the dancers being sort of scantily clad or whatever like that, that maybe, you know, people
would you be clutching your pearls at that kind of thing?
Well, again, not quite, I have to say. But anyway, move on to Saturday, and I started seeing things on social media that apparently, now I had sort of perceived, and people will remember it, it almost looked like a fashion show to begin with, where a group of people were sort of sitting at what essentially looked like more like a catwalk, and, you know, people, models sort of moved up and down. Later it became a dance scene. But apparently if you looked at it particular ways, and you know, there are now photographs, it does look like the Last Supper, that particular scene where you've got all the people sitting on one particular side of the table and there's somebody in the middle. So anyway, a group of people have now interpreted this as being offensive, because it is sort of, you know, making fun or whatever of a very central story for Christians. So I mean, I found it just fascinating. It's one of these sort of things. It's always just interesting to sort of see what people pick
what
up.
What blows being, up.
Yeah, yeah. And what people find offensive. And I said, in this like incredibly captivating 4 hours, you know, the idea that people would have locked into this, I thought was interesting.
You would have thought if people who were of a mind to clutch their pearls, that the kind of pansexual threesome that was a major storyline.
Well,
they clearly went into a room with one thing on their minds and closed the door on the camera. Well, I would have thought if you were wanted to get upset.
Absolutely. Now, just the one other sort of twist on it that I found interesting is this. I don't know if this was the French in a sense saying, well, we're almost like an equal opportunity insulter, because obviously a number of years ago there was the issues around Charlie Hebdo and perceptions that they were insulting Islamic values or whatever. And so at one level I was thinking you'd imagine they'd be very, very sort of sensitive to this sort of thing. But again, maybe there was sort of something more devious about it.
What they call the laïcité is something they hold very dear, isn't it? It's one of their values, which is...
very fancy word. I don't even understand.
Yeah, I think it's a core value of some French people, and which is that religion plays no part in anything.
Totally.
Mary, were you offended by it?
Interestingly, my niece rang me yesterday, absolutely incensed by it.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Is she a deeply religious person?
No, she's not a deeply religious person, but her point was they wouldn't do it to Muslims. And we were actually, as it happens, both in Paris when Charlie Hebdo happened, right? So very conscious of the fact that here was an attack on the Muslim religion and the reaction to it, right? Or that was the perception of it. But I was really interested that it came from a young person like her, and she was saying that it was a world audience. It's a family occasion, as you had people from everywhere of all ages looking at it kind of thing, and that it was deeply offensive to Christians.
Okay.
So can I just ask her, did she notice it at the time?
No, that's a very good question. I don't know.
So I had the same. Yeah. My 16-year-old son and my 19-year-old son both separately said, did you see what the French did? That was their initial. So the two of them didn't watch the ceremony. They saw this small TikTok video that actually is criticising them. And the two of them now have these. Now, my 19-year-old, to be fair, he does have quite... religious. He is quite religious.
Really, yeah.
But the 16-year-old isn't at all. But like, he's always looking to hang himself on some kind of social point at this age. And for him, he was like, this is totally wrong, ma'am. They wouldn't have done this. It was any other religion. And Jesus, we love Jesus. I was like, okay, Ty, you're taking it way too far now at this point.
Young people take up the religion now.
No, he was very shocked because it was drag queens and because of the crown that the middle drag queen wore, it was a direct criticism.
Because it seems, in France, it seems to be mainly the far right are taking. So the far right have gone so far right and the woke have come around to meet them at the other end.
Yeah.
Sarah, you're probably the closest we have to, are you woke? I would like to think I'm woke and I'm not offended here.
I'm not offended, but also I'm not really in the business of telling people not to be offended by something because that rarely works. But I thought it was an absolutely marvellous celebration. And actually people who I follow on Instagram were kind of saying, this is absolutely so cool to see a society as divided and as kind of volatile as France right now celebrating all the various kind of diversities that the modern world has to offer. You know, the argument of kind of, oh, well, they wouldn't do this to Muslims. Well, I believe that there's been like a lot of, you know, there's been a lot more kind of targeted hate towards Muslims than, in my case anyway, a white Catholic, that I'm kind of like, do you know what, if they want to poke fun at me, fair enough. Like, I've gotten off pretty lightly the past while. I'm not personally offended. I thought the whole ceremony was absolutely like a divine spectacle, and like, you know, like it was just a really exciting watch. But also, if people are a bit upset about it, the French don't seem to be mind too much.
Yeah. I think Muslims would have found a lot to upset them in it all as well, in other ways, you know. I thought if it was a take on anything, was it not a take on a work of art, like on that that image of Leonardo's, which is that religion anymore, or is that just an iconic piece of art?
Well, it does feature in the Bible, that the meal does, I think. But the funny
but you know what I'm saying. Do you get one removed then when it becomes a painting, that is in all our heads? Like,
I think what was interesting, though, was the response from France, or some French people. They said, oh, well, it's been represented in The Simpsons, so why can we not represent it in the Olympics? You know, there's been a parody of this picture done. And it is true. Yeah.
And given parodies, that everything that was in The Simpsons is now coming true in the real world.
That's another point of my 16-year-olds, that we should be looking at The Simpsons to know what's happening in the world rather than school.
Yeah, he probably has a point. Sean in Cork says, hi, Brendan. I think there is a very strong case for Ireland to withdraw from the Olympics after the disgraceful, disgusting, anti-Christian opening ceremony. Someone else says it was depravity. Someone else says it was obvious watching it was a parody of The Last Supper. Yeah, someone else says it was a reference to a painting, to a work of art. Okay, well, look, sure, these kind of sideshows is what makes the Olympics anyway, all the little dramas on the side and everything, isn't it?
Except Katrina, speaking of the Olympics, I see Mona McSharry has just come second in her 100 metres breaststroke, so she's obviously into the final.
Yeah, you know, that's fantastic news.
Are you watching television?
No.
focus. Okay, well done to her. And you wanted to highlight, Katrina, another story in the Sunday Independent about a boxer called Aoife O'Rourke.
Oh, yeah. So I just wanted to highlight, actually, how amazing it is that we have equal numbers of men and women going to the Olympics this year. It's never happened before. We had the first Irish woman to go to the Olympics was in 1953. Her name was Maeve Kyle. She was a runner. And now we have equal men and women, which is phenomenal. But yeah, Aoife O'Rourke, I suppose, is a boxer. She just represents one of the amazing women that are going, but like in boxing particularly, we have a woman in every single category, which has never happened before. But Aoife actually took up boxing late in life. It was, well, later in terms of sport. She was 16.
Yeah.
She'd never boxed before. She was a GAA player. She has a big, big GAA history. But I just thought it was amazing to celebrate the fact that you can get into sport later at any age, and also maybe make it to the Olympics. Now, I think my Olympic dream is over at this point, but
Were you a boxer?
I boxed. I've played sport my whole life. I love sport, but I boxed, especially when I moved to Dublin. I boxed in Corinthians Boxing Club, shout out to the club. But yeah, I did. I loved boxing, but it's been fantastic to see, I suppose, the growth in the sport for women, but also now the representation across all the weights. And just to see like that we actually have medal hopes, and a lot of them are in the female categories, which is just, it's amazing to see. And I just think it's something that we should be celebrating and talking about a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Have you all been sucked in by the Olympics yet? Alan, you seem like the kind of person who will sit down and watch whatever's going
14 hours a day because I've nothing better to be doing. Yeah. It is really captivating. And even already, I found myself watching the judo yesterday. You know, the way sometimes you just flip on the television and there are things
on. I turned into a badminton match last night. It was incredible.
Exactly.
Like.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah. And there's great often sort of backstories on the athletes themselves. And it's wonderful. And I'm really looking forward now to the next.
I think the
weeks.
Fact that it's in the same time zone makes a big really difference awesome. For us. Yeah. And just flip on the television and you're actually looking at it live.
Or indeed, if you're on a panel on the radio, you can be
just flipping on the television. I'm really glad that Katrina didn't keep up with the boxing.
Yes.
Because it should be said, noted in all the papers today, that her book, Poor, is number one still in the non-fiction paperback in Ireland.
Yeah, yes. Still going.
Well done.
Extraordinary phenomenon. Well done.
Thank you.
Okay, there's lots to get through today. So why don't we move on to America, which is still convulsing us all. Sarah, will we start with Eric Trump? Niamh Horan has an interview with him in the Sunday Independent, just to warm us up for America.
Yeah, so this is actually like a really enjoyable read. I got a great kick out of it. Eric Trump sat down with Niamh Horan, and he's coming to Doonbeg next week. So it was kind of ahead of that. And obviously his family have been through a lot of upheaval in the last fortnight with an assassination attempt on his father, and have really kind of publicly rallied around him and, you know, are only short of wearing ear bandages in solidarity, as many MAGA supporters have. But yeah, he spoke very candidly. And I think it's actually so funny when you kind of see someone like a Trump speaking kind of so offhandedly, because, you know, Donald Trump's speech are so like deliberately written and they're so purposefully written, even though they might not come across that way. But it's just also the kind of level of delusion that they have. You're kind of like, wow, we lead such incredibly different lives. Like within the first like couple of paragraphs, Eric Trump actually is kind of saying like, oh, it's insane that, like, you know, the Secret Services didn't accost this like live shooter, which, to be fair, it is insane. And their excuse, I think, was that they didn't want to stand on the roof because there was too much of a slant or something. Like, it was a bit of a, you know, they dropped the ball on that one. But he was kind of saying like, if that had been me, as in talking about taking aim at his own father, if that had been me, I would have made that shot. I would have completely made it. And like,
he likens it to a short putt. Like, well, he's exactly saying the guy shouldn't have been there, but I suppose that's not delusion. He has a point. Like,
no, but also it's just such a bizarre thing to say, kind of like, if I had been that shooter, I would have been able to make that. And it just kind of, I don't know, it was just a bit juvenile. And then anyway, he kind of speaks about his father's relationship with Ireland, and again, it's this kind of like just kind of delusion. He was kind of like, well, my father's done so much for the Irish economy with his Doonbeg thing, like with his Doonbeg hotel, and like, yeah, obviously that's a great tourist attraction, but like, I don't know, it's just, it's hilarious to see them.
Listen,
they'll be
texting from Doonbeg now to say that he has.
The delusion is further than Doonbeg, because he actually says in that interview, Ukraine would not have happened if his father had been president.
No, literally. And I remember the first time I was like cognizant of kind of Donald Trump, well, one of the first times, it was when I was about like 15 or something, and he was obviously, you know, running for the presidential election, and there had been this big high profile shooting, and he was out speaking afterwards, and he literally said, well, if I would have been there, I personally would have body tackled the shooter and the whole problem would have been solved. And it's just this kind of mentality of kind of like, well, we can do anything because we're the Trumps. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, okay, it's very interesting.
So we've talked enough about him now, because Kamala was the woman of the week. And Alan, you have picked two pieces here. Louise Callaghan, a social media star, but she needs fans to log off and vote. That's in the Sunday Times. And also in the Sunday Times, a brilliant piece by Camilla Long, I have to say. One of the best pieces in the paper today.
Yeah, so I mean, I chose the two pieces because, I mean, generally the reaction to Kamala is very positive. And I mean, a lot of the stories today are about this new dynamic in the presidential race. A lot of the discussion about how, you know, Trump thought he was going to be going against Biden, and the entire narrative around the old man. And all of a sudden you have this, you know, relatively youthful individual who's really hit the ground running, and all the money she's raised. And, you know, there's talk in that article you mentioned just about the excitement supposedly that she has created. And there's no doubt she does look like a very strong candidate, very interesting person. But the second article that you mentioned, which is in the Times, Camilla Long, she just raises this issue, just how manufactured American political personalities actually are. And up until about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Kamala Harris generally would have been viewed as something of a failure in the role of the vice presidency. You can give all sorts of reasons as to why, like, not many vice presidents have you know, shone. Dick Cheney was one of the few who in a sense had a very, very high profile when he was vice president. There's also the case that Kamala Harris's own presidential campaign a number of years ago completely tanked. So there are questions, you know, about her sort of capacity. There's also issues around, like, what do we actually know? Like, Like, what does she believe in? What are her policies? What are her views? What are her thoughts? And we don't know really any of these sort of things. But the long article really is just about the extent to which the image machine moves in. And there's a brilliant parallel, actually. She talks about, like, we're supposedly worried about this being an AI-dominated election where all these, you know, fake profiles are going to be developed. But, I mean, here you have, I'm not saying it's fake, but that you just have an effort to create an image around somebody before we actually know who they are and what
they stand for. And it's working to some extent. She has a great line where she says that Kamala is the candidate for people who wish Michelle Obama was running. Mary? Are you excited about Kamala?
I'm excited that the campaign has taken a different direction because I think the Democrats were really despairing. Many of them were actually saying, no, if you listen to the debate and what he was saying was absolutely wonderful and his policies were great. And you couldn't question that. But politics, particularly in America, has as much to do with image and perception and how you present it. And unfortunately, he presented as an elderly man who wasn't able for this job into the future. Right. So undoubtedly, the Democrats are now definitely energised. Young Democrats that I know, East Coast America, you know, have suddenly really got enthused again. She's after bringing in $100 million in a week. I think it'll give an energy and it'll also carry through beyond their convention, which is coming up in August. So that'll give her continue with the momentum. It's in September then, I think, that the real campaign will actually start. Because up to now, it's been Trump against Biden. The nasty words are now kind of starting.
Yeah.
He's weird. His rhetoric is weird. Now, that's actually not going to help her. She shouldn't lower herself to using his type of language.
Yeah. That's actually a brilliant point, because in the 2020 general election, like, you know, Biden was so able to handle Trump, and Kamala Harris, and I think this is like completely been forgotten about, she is not a strong public speaker, really, which is really unfortunate for her. And, you know, obviously this kind of Biden-Harris union came about, and there was that iconic video of her saying, "We did it, Joe," and it was a mass celebration. Within a year, she was kind of pulled right back because she did not resonate with anyone.
No, and she still doesn't resonate. So it's funny to see how we respond to her and then others, especially in the US. So she has this habit, whether it's good or bad, but she kind of giggles before she speaks about really important topics, which the American public don't really like. And I thought what was really interesting this week was J.D. Vance's comments about the childless cat lady. And I've read this kind of like she's like this childless woman who can never have policies or understand policies for people who have families. That's J.D. Vance and the Trump take on it. And so there's the other side of it, who are calling her like pro-abortion and are really criticising her for her women's rights. So I think with Kamala, we have to consider the fact that she's a woman as well and what that does in terms of perception. And if she goes in and fights Trump with a like in that tone, it will go against her as a woman because we're not allowed to actually behave like men do in that space. So she really needs to be managed well if she's going to have any chance.
And Hillary Clinton took the opposite tack of kind of giving him room so as not to be seen as this kind of hysterical. She tried to kind of rise above, but that didn't work either. Yeah, it's really complex.
Okay, we could keep on with that for the rest of the hour, but there's lots more. The Eamon Casey story continues. Mary, you picked Maria Cahill in the Sunday Independent. Why is it so hard to believe men like Casey can be evil?
There's a couple of stories with Casey, and it's front page of the Mail on Sunday as well. And I suppose it's bringing us back to again, that whole idea of perception, that people in authority, people who are likeable, can't possibly be evil. I remember Eamon Casey as Archbishop. I remember the youth mass in Galway with the Pope. Himself and Michael Cleary were the two big church figures who were there. And so everybody liked them because they were public figures. They related well to people. And then suddenly that image was shattered. About Casey and Annie Murphy. But however bad that was seen at the time, I think there was a view, well, in light of all of the child abuse, that was a woman and a natural male-female relationship, be it wrong within the context of the church and celibacy and et cetera, et cetera. But this is beyond being acceptable in any way. and it has absolutely destroyed people's views of people who we thought were good in authority. Yeah.
You know, if Catholics are looking for something to get offended about, I think a bunch of people doing the Last Supper is the least of it. Katrina, yeah. You picked the pieces on that as well, the Mail and the Maria Call piece.
Yeah, just for me, I think there's a part of me when I knew this play that it was going to be on the TV, the show, there was like this despondent feeling of, again, another cover up in the church. And so I wasn't here when it came out originally, but I went back and I watched the Gayburn interview on The Late Late with
Annie Murphy.
Yes, and the way she was vilified, that woman, around the relationship with him, as if it was her fault. And now for this truth to emerge around them knowing that not only what did he have that relationship with her, and obviously, you know, took advantage in that circumstance, but he was abusing children and they were hiding it. So a part of me was just like, well, this is what happens in the church. You know, it wasn't a new information for me. But what's interesting, what you talked about there, Mary, is this thing, the value system around Usher. Well, he broke his vows, but it was with a woman. It wasn't too bad. And now he's turned into this real, real villain. And the question is, like, he's in the cathedral. Like, what's going to happen now?
Reflecting on that now, there seems to be a process of reflecting on it. Alan?
I suppose people of my sort of generation find this fascinating because in a sense, it was 1992, I think, when the original story broke. I would have been 24 at the time. And I think we didn't sort of realise it at the time. But in many ways, what has happened sort of since then has utterly transformed the Ireland in which we live. I mean, it is quite remarkable. Obviously, on the child abuse issues, you know, everybody understands, absolutely horrendous. But I have to say, one of the things the programme did for me was to rethink about his relationship with Annie Murphy. And by that, I mean, I wasn't as aware at the time that she was firstly 20 years younger than him. And it also arrived in Ireland because she was going through a divorce and she was almost sent over in some sense to be looked after. So, I mean, I think I don't know how much that was discussed at the time, but I think now we are much more aware of these notions of power imbalances between men and women.
Yeah.
And then, or some, you know, people in general. But then it seemed that when he was doing supposedly like very good work in Britain with the Irish immigrant community, he was also essentially preying on vulnerable women. Obviously the child abuse was up, but even his relationships with adult women was not really of what we would now consider a sort of a standard consensual sort of thing. And I actually have to wonder if that Gayburn interview happened now, would Gayburn actually have to resign?
Yeah.
And because I'm thinking, for example, do you remember George Hook got into tremendous difficulty when he talked about but I just think I'm using it to illustrate that our perception of these sort of engagement relationships has changed so utterly.
I think there was a certain reaction from the audience as well.
The audience, that was it.
And also, the thing that Gay is really vilified for is saying, well, if your son is half the man his father was. And you know what? When you're on air in situations, you can try and say something, you can botch things and everything. Like, was it as pointed as it was meant to be, or was he?
But my point, it wasn't just Gay, so it wasn't at Gay. It was at the audience response, the messages that were coming in, the women that were in the audience. So it was a whole societal attack on her. And what I thought was interesting when we were talking before, Mary, was the amount of people, the amount of bishops and priests that were actually at his funeral. That actually went to his funeral and celebrated his life. And they must have known. There is people there who must have known of the allegations.
Well, I don't know if they all knew about child abuse. I mean, Dermot Martin is in the papers today saying he didn't go because of the Annie Murphy situation, and also because I think of Casey's friendship with Michael Cleary. And look, we can look back on that as dark chapters and everything, but we are still men are abusing women in all kinds of ways, and there's just again this week so much of it in the papers. Sarah, you picked two pieces here. One is the editorial in the Sunday Indo, and then you wanted to contrast it with a piece in the Mail on Sunday.
Yeah, so I've actually, the Raymond Shorten cases, I completely tuned out of it, because in the last 2 months alone, Natasha O'Brien has, you know, been an absolute force and a really courageous beacon in what is like a horrendous case. There was that lady, and I cannot remember her surname for the life of me, but Blonid, who spoke in these studios as well about
Blonid Raleigh.
Blonid Raleigh. And now there is this. And the Sunday Times have kind of done an op-ed on their back page, and it's kind of saying that this verdict against Raymond Shorten is like some hope, it would restore some faith in the justice system. And you have to just laugh, like, thinking about it, because literally this is like the most heinous of crimes, and a man has got like an appropriate sentence, and we're celebrating it. And even touch on the fact that they even touch on the Aisling Murphy verdict, saying like it's kind of reminiscent of that, of, oh, justice is served. I don't feel relief that justice is served. I don't feel relief at all. And it's just, it's absolutely insane. And literally, one of your production team, Brendan, rang me on Friday, and we were just kind of discussing the issues dominating the week. As soon as she hung up, an RTE alert came through on my phone of another verdict in a femicide case. Mm. Like, this is an insane problem. So, like, no, I don't. My faith isn't restored in the justice system. I literally closed this Sindo. I opened a copy of the Mail. On page 32, there is this really harrowing read about how women in the court system, mothers in the family court system, are being told not to bring up cases of domestic violence and sexual abuse because they'll be seen as being vindictive. Mm-hmm. And there's this thing called
parental alienation,
which is a deeply flawed thing.
And it's not real.
It's not real, whereby basically, like, this concept that
somebody is trying to brainwash the child against their parents.
Yes, that's not real.
And it's not real. And United Nations have said that this is unfounded and deeply, like, genderly biased. But, like, practicing legal professionals are warning women against this. Three women spoke to the Mail about it. Mm. It is absolutely insane. And basically the argument is, well, if you can't get a criminal conviction in court, this, like, that argument has no place in family law. Yeah. The argument that you are a survivor of domestic abuse, or your children are, that has no place in the family court system.
It might make you seem bitter or something.
Vindictive is the word.
Vindictive.
Mary, do you know, as a barrister, do you know about this situation?
Okay, can I clarify? So I'm a barrister for a week. Yeah. Okay. I do know that the Department of Justice are doing a study on parental alienation to see.
Yeah, and I think the minister has said she is going to change.
Yeah, and absolutely looking at it. And I mean, the family courts are fraught enough without this as well. But I mean, there are reports that have to be done for family law about the effect on children, you know, Section 32 reports, I think, and about children's welfare. And they all have to be independent reports that are brought forward in the courts, you know. But going back to the Shorten story, if I might, I mean, Brenda Power has an absolutely powerful piece in the Sunday Times today. She is raging. Yeah. And it just jumps out of her words, where she's talking about this Shorten is going to rot in jail and it's about time. Yeah. And she's really, really strong about him, about his attitude, about the fact that Legal Aid has paid for his case. And I mean, her words should be listened to. But also, I have to say, the words of Judge Paul McDermott this week, the sentencing was one thing, but actually his sentencing comments were really very apt, and I think government should be listening to it as well, because he's saying that it reflects the unhappy reality that women are too often subject to sexual and other forms of abuse, an underlying unhealthy attitude towards women. Now, that's the court speaking. So I think that is the type of comment and the type of attitude that should restore our faith in the justice system, but just not just the sentence.
Okay, I can see Katrina's error, not as impressed.
Well, I agree the sentence is great, it's fantastic, but the inconsistency in sentencing is a real issue. So that we should be looking at that and making sure everybody's getting hard sentencing for crimes like this. The thing that I want to draw your attention to as well is, like, Miriam Henry and her sister this week, their brother was found guilty of child sex abuse, and there was a story that actually highlight, they had to sit through the character references of a convicted paedophile and people standing in court saying,
For character references for him.
For his sentencing. Like, if you're a victim and it's actually been proven, your case, that he was found guilty, and to sit there and have person upon person stand up and say, he's a really good GAA player, he's a great member of the club, he's a good husband, like, that is really letting down women. We can't have inconsistency in this. In the verdicts, great, we had a great verdict, but we've got a case of a verdict 3 weeks ago that was absolutely let women down totally.
And for every judge that is commenting, acknowledging the endemic problem that is violence against women, there's another judge saying, well, Cathal Crotty is a young man at the start of his career.
Let's be careful.
On the victim statement, I mean, I think in future, if you write a character reference, you can now be called in and be cross-examined on it.
Yeah. Katrina, as a survivor yourself.
Yes, I said this when I was talking. Like, I didn't report rape when I was in my early 20s. Not necessarily, I just didn't think I'd be believed at the end of the day because it was someone that I knew. But I don't think I would report. The fact you're treated like the criminal, I think the victim a lot of the time has to go through an awful lot to bring a case. There's a long time, there's a long wait, your life is on hold, you've been through the trauma. And then there's the situation that goes on, like the cases that we've read about, the inconsistencies are something that I wouldn't want to put myself.
So we talk about these people, women being brave for coming forward. You shouldn't have to be brave.
No, you shouldn't have to be brave, and you should be protected in all cases. The idea that women are going to report and it not be true, I just think that sometimes transcends things, and we give too much weight to the perpetrator or someone who's been accused and not to the victim, the person who's saying they're a victim. And the majority of women who do come forward are victims. Most women don't report sexual crimes because they are afraid of the justice system. They're not afraid of the perpetrator, they're afraid of the process, and that should be changed.
Okay. Well, look, at the same time, we can say that this week was not enough and what the judge said and the sentence, but at least it was a step in the right direction, hopefully. Okay, we'll take a break. Our panel staying with us, Sarah McGuinness, Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan, Mary Hanifin and Alan Barrett.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Expert advice on vitamins to help build immunity at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Alan Barrett, Sarah McGuinness, Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan and Mary Hanifin. Mary, immigration is a big story practically every week now. I suppose Coolock has been driving a lot of the narrative for the last couple of weeks, and it's still an ongoing situation. What are your thoughts on that?
I think negative stories are driving the narrative. I think a lot of what's happening in Coolock is absolute thuggery. It's just people who are gathering who are really out to make trouble, and has very little to do with the local community. But where the government is failing is actually broadcasting the good news stories. I mean, Sinn Féin policy is saying, oh, the better off areas should be taking some of these refugees. There are nearly 300 in the centre of Blackrock. 300, and not a dicky bird. Because the local business association, the local public representatives, the local principals, the local resident associations all came together before these people came to the centre of Blackrock, organised a meeting with the department, got real answers to real questions, and then the public representatives, we sent out a letter, 7,000 copies all around, saying, don't mind what you hear. It's not 1,300 people, it's 300 people. It will be properly managed. This is what's going to happen.
But and look, this shouldn't make any difference. What's the makeup of the 300
They're not
people?
Ukrainians. Right. Yeah. So it's a mix of people. It's a mix of families and single people.
Okay.
Right. And single men.
But there was consultation and there was consultation, there was a lot of
communication. And I have to say, they're generated mostly by local people in a very positive way. And it also showed that as soon as a lot of these families and people arrived, that a lot of volunteers came forward to support
Maybe
them.
Maybe people in Blackrock aren't waiting as long for a GP appointment. Maybe they have better services. They don't feel threatened by 300 more people coming into the community.
Well, they certainly felt that they were going to welcome them, and all of the schools absorbed the children. And as it would happen in any school in the country, they would get extra teachers, they would get extra supports. I think there's a general difficulty all over the country with GPs. You know, it's very hard to get a GP anywhere. So the services in Blackrock would be under the same pressure as they would be
okay.
in Coolock.
Can so, Katrina,
it's a difference of attitude.
Right?
So
Coolock, just we saw, in Mary's word, Tuggery.
Yes.
And Blackrock, we're seeing a civilised.
So I'm just going to say, firstly, I'm really delighted to see working class people standing up and having a voice in their community and having an opinion and standing up and
saying. You're talking about Coolock.
I'm talking about the people, the good working class people from the community of Coolock who've had enough of being underserved by this government and being dumped upon, standing and protesting silently, not violently, and having a voice. I'm delighted to see that in any community. Now, the reality is, so I know Mary said about BlackRock, like I'm an academic, I'm a researcher, I've tried to access the data of where people are housed. And to try to actually answer this conversation, which is saying that they're being put in poorer communities, the data is not there. You're lucky enough to be involved in your community, so you know. So we don't know actually where they are, whether it's true.
Like a lot of it seems, a lot of them are in rural Ireland.
Yeah.
And they're in Dundrum, Central Mental Hospital, they're in Rathmines as well. There's one opening in Ballsbridge.
But the data is not there. And actually, like the communication from Simon Harris, the government, around what's happening in Coolock, for me, is totally inappropriate. All they're talking about is policing and policing. Thuggery. I heard scumbag again this week. The reality is this, like we live in a democracy. People have an issue with this topic and they're actually their voice in that issue. Violence is never okay and it's not acceptable. But the reality is our government should be doing stuff to waylay the fears. And one of the fears and one of the reasons that this is happening is because people in that community, now you talked about schools, the average class size in Coolock comparison to Blackrock is massively different. So it's like 35 kids in Coolock versus 20 or something in Blackrock. So it's
is that correct?
Oh, there's a smaller class size on average in more affluent communities.
Okay. Well, so, the DESH scheme would ensure, and Coolock will be in the DESH scheme.
Hiring teachers in DESH schools to supplement the increase of students that are coming in based on migration is not there. So we can't hire the teachers to increase the class sizes, to reduce the class sizes if there's more pressure put on. So that's a problem as is, even in schools. But the reality is this, what we need to be doing is not talking about policing. We need to be explaining what's happening. Like I live in a lovely community. I welcome migration. I want diversity in the community. But I don't understand why we're bringing in so many men are being handed tents and then moved into a factory space in Coolock. I don't know the numbers. I can't find the reality of the information. So if I can't, then these communities that are currently and have been underserved for many, many years and are now being galvanised through social media, we need to make sure that they have the correct information. So if it is the case that the migrants are being spread around equally across the country, then tell people that in a kind way, rather than
Mary,
talking about policing
that?
Them.
That it's not the fault of individuals out in Coolock what happened there. That it's
no, and I'm not blaming any individual.
Problem.
And I'm certainly not blaming the community of Coolock or the Northside Partnership and all the people who are genuinely trying to make efforts to support and to integrate anybody coming to live in their community. And I can appreciate that maybe the people of Dunleary, Blackrock, Rathmines, wherever, don't want to let it be known exactly where the immigrants, the refugees, the asylum seekers are being housed for fear of these protests, because you don't want that either. But there is a good news story to be told out there. And I think Katrina's right. I mean, the government needs to indicate, no, this is happening. It's not just in any particular area in the city.
Yeah.
Okay, Alan.
I found the last number of weeks extremely depressing, I have to say, and almost frightening in a little way. So, I mean, Katrina talks about, you know, the importance of communities, sort of fighting for their community. And I think, of course, everybody understands and believes that people should fight for their own communities. I just think what's absolutely horrible is the extent to which fighting for your community has involved shouting abuse at immigrants, writing racist graffiti on walls. I think it's been absolutely horrible. And in all of these discussions, I hate when we move down this direction, that we start talking about housing and education and healthcare and all these sort of things, and mix it in with the issue of asylum seeking and migration. These should be just utterly separate things. We have a housing crisis because we're not building enough houses. We've got problems in our healthcare because we're not hiring enough doctors. There are a whole range of things that are happening. Why this is mixed in with the immigration story, I have to say, I find really, really troubling. And if you go back to the sort of...
What do you think of that, Katrina?
Well, it's mixed in with, because we have to put these people in communities that have the resources to look after them. And the reality is, I totally agree, anybody being shouted at or having racist or ethnic abuse is wrong.
Okay, but what about mixing,
but like mixing
the immigration
discussion with the discussion
of housing, etc.?
There's pressure in certain communities. There's been pressure for years. Poverty... homelessness, lack of resources are seen in communities like Coolock. And so now we want to add a further group into that who don't have access to the resources. Now, it's not that I'm saying it's right to do that. But like, if you're coming from that community and you've years like I had of being underserved, of not getting anywhere and not being housed, not being able to work, not being able to succeed in education, and you just see this other group, you know, this in-group, out-group, this other group who look like they're getting more, then the reality is the reaction is going to be there. And the truth is this, like, they have to be housed in places where there's available amenities to them and not more pressure being placed on them in terms of homelessness and education and the medical stuff, the hospital, the access to...
Alan, to wit, if you're in a community that has been neglected, no opportunities, etc., and you see people coming in and you perceive that they are getting everything...
But again, even the way you put it there, you know, this
I'm not putting it that way.
But what you are doing is you are echoing
what Katrina said.
I think you're going a little bit further. The line you use there.
That's exactly what Katrina said.
Well, okay, well, let's not fall over the details.
I'm putting that discussion.
Well, let me come back and say, okay, some people come out with this line, oh, immigrants are coming in and getting everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
You'd stand over that perception.
No, that's not true, though.
But that's the point.
But it's not true, as a perception.
In shows like this, we need to be talking about what's actually the case, all right?
Yeah.
Okay? You're talking about...
We also
about
need to try and understand people who aren't as privileged as we might all be around this table, and how they might see things.
Yes, and we need to, you know, try and understand, and we're doing that. This is all part of the process, all
but
right?
But we're not understanding.
What I am doing is drawing a line at the point that groups of people are shouting racist abuse at asylum seekers.
But that's
And what I'm trying to do is talk and have the conversation around how are we going to change this narrative, okay, that we're not repeating the sort of tropes that are out there, and instead we're saying to people, yes, you are absolutely right, your community has been underserved. Now let's actually solve the problem by investing in your community and doing positive sort of things rather than mixing it in. Really what's happening is that, you know, communities are being taken over by a very, very nasty group of people who are peddling misinformation. Okay, and stirring up a whole load of difficulties. And I still come back to that notion. If you accept that, you know, while there may be false asylum claims, when you look at poor, unfortunate people who are fleeing from horrendous circumstances and then being abused in the way that has been happened. And again, it's a small point, but one of the parts of that really upsets me is the flying of the Irish flag in some sort of sense that this is who we are.
The idea that these people in these poor communities are being like led by these right wing bad people actually diminishes the cognitive capacity of them people. The feeling of I've had enough. Okay, so these people there are some really dark forces at the moment, and I see them, and I agree with you, Alan. It's absolutely disgraceful to see the way people are being treated. But this narrative that these right-wing people are taking advantage of these poor, mindless thugs in this community, and now they're standing up and doing this violent acts. It really diminishes the capabilities of the people in them communities. And there are good, honest, working class people who have a problem with what's happening. And so, yeah, we need to separate things out a little bit, but we also need to have a better, I agree with you, we need to have a better language. We can't just talk about a whole group of people from the mindset of that they're mindless and they're being led by these right-wing zealots. The truth is this, it's complicated. And our responsibility, I agree, in this programme, but also in the government, is to be mindful of that and to do stuff to be able to empower communities, stop the zealots, and also protect the migrants. And right now what we're doing is, all we're doing is blaming the mindless thugs in Coolock, and we're having no conversation around why there are good people there who are standing up and maybe being led by this. And that's my point. And I would have been that person. So I know 30 years ago, without education and without access to services, I definitely would have been standing and saying, why am I not getting anything? Why are these people getting things? And that would have been an untruth, but that would have been because of the community and my experiences in life. And I think it is complicated, but we also need to not throw these people under the bus and suggest that they're mindless, because they're not.
But you see, we now have examples of best friends.
I certainly wasn't suggesting that people were mindless. I mean, it's quite the opposite. I mean, really what I'm saying is, I fully understand, okay, and I grew up in the parish of Donnycarney, which is a stone's throw from Coolock's, okay, so this is somewhat familiar territory. What I'm talking about is the need to do the positive sort of investments that we need to do and to break the cycles of inequality in this country. I absolutely agree with all of that. But to the extent that I'm sort of expressing frustration and sort of annoyance and all these sort of things, it's the mixing of this with the group.
And, historically, 15, when we start blaming
The thing about it is that, exactly, and no, like every society almost in the world throughout history has blamed immigrants for something. Okay, so for us at the moment, it's housing. But if you go back over history, it was unemployment, it was disease, crime. It's always the immigrants. Okay, and the Irish have been part of that group who've been blamed over time. And I think this is just why the whole narrative just upsets me.
Maybe briefly, and have to take a break then.
But we now have examples of best practice, which should be shared. I mean, before they opened the centre in Blackrock, they brought up the manager of the one from Macroom, which is very well run, to explain to people how it's going to happen. These are going to be the food preparation areas. This is what's going to happen with all of the services, etc. And when that happened, it allayed all fears.
Well, it sounds to me like the Good Burgers of Blackrock had a much more elaborate system.
But it was driven by the community and the businesses in Blackrock.
Okay, but it does sound like there was a good model of good practice there that maybe could be put into place in other places. Okay, I have to take a break. Alan Barrett, Sarah McGuinness, Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan and Mary Hannafin staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Alan Barrett, Sarah McGuinness, Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan and Mary Hannafin. And Sarah McGuinness, will you tell us, please, about Ken Fox's story? It's in the Mail on Sunday today, and it's elsewhere too, about the central bankers having a jolly in Mount Juliet, was it?
I would absolutely love to. So the 26 delegates of the European Central Bank were flown to Ireland for a kind of convention to, you know, come together.
A retreat, they're calling it.
A hollybop is what I would call it. Nearly €400,000 spent on this holiday, which included five-star accommodation, golf buggies, presentation mints, a Hurley display, and yeah, just it sounds like.
How much does a Hurley display cost these days?
€1,500 for Christine Lagarde to watch a couple of people run around the pitch. It is absolute lunacy. It's nearly £400 spent on a harpist. Like, what is going on here? Katrina had a really good one on that. There was how much? €1,400
on a pen
spent on bespoke Parker pens.
I want to get myself one of them pens. Like, I want to be in a position to get a pen from that delegate.
There is an awful air.
There's thousands spent on notepads as well.
Yeah. Thousands spent on notepads. Mount Juliet got a great deal out of it. There was almost €40,000 spent on putting them up in Mount Juliet. 90,000 euro bill for chauffeur services. Jesus, lads, I'd love to be a central banker. This sounds like absolutely brilliant crack.
I know.
But I, like, I cannot get over the hurling display and the harp. It's like the most diddly eye, like, demonstration of all time. But I was actually reading that and then I turned over to the Business Post and I saw that the unicorn was opening back up. Mm. And are we in 2007? This
we're
is back, absolutely
babies.
Hilarious.
Yeah, okay.
We're back there. We're back there.
And I will just say that the ECB has every year has two meetings outside of Frankfurt. And the last time Ireland hosted one was 2007. So it was our time to do it again. I'll just say that on behalf of our friends.
Let's defend it.
In the central bank. Mary, really briefly, you wanted to mention Sinead O'Connor, a year on from her death. I think everyone's been thinking about her this week, but you are very glad that the waxwork has been dispatched.
I think there's two stories about Sinead O'Connor. One was the actual cause of her death was registered, respiratory illness and bronchial infection and that. I mean, it was such an awful tragedy and we should remember her this year. And the wax image, which wasn't a wax image of Sinead O'Connor, I don't know who or what, it could have been any one of us sitting around the table, but it took her brother to be the one to say, please remove it. Now, in fairness to them, they did remove it very, very quickly, but in no way resembled her. And the other problem was where they were citing it, situating it in the wax museum was beside Star Wars.
It was in the Star Wars display, apparently. So it was kind of like next to Yoda. I just think our wax works. I don't know if you've ever seen the Ryan Tubridy one, but it actually looks like Kenneth Williams. It's like a recycled. It's like honestly.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that.
Yeah, I
or Matthew
see that.
Kelly.
Okay.
So like it's like.
Yeah,
it's
I could see that too. Yeah.
I think it's good that she would be in the wax museum, but please let it look like her.
Okay.
God rest
yes.
her.
Thank you very much to my excellent panel this morning. That was a very thought-provoking discussion. Alan Barrett, CEO of the SRI. Sarah McGinn, Assistant News Editor of the Business Post, Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan of Maynooth University and author, of course, of Poor, the continuing bestseller, and Mary Hannafin, former Minister for Education and new baby barrister. And now at 12 noon, we'll go to the newsroom and Maggie Doyle.